Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
part of the reason that I enjoyed it, and it's about 650 pages, I think, something like that. But you know, I read it because I knew that it was based on John's research, and for me, it was kind of encouraging to know that what was there is all there is. I mean, if there's anything else left out there, or a lot of stuff unplowed sources that we don't know about, that's it. We don't know about them. But everything that we know about is there now, and Pauline Meyer has pretty much told the story in a pretty good case. The only thing that I would say before I let John take over, as teachers, ratification, for the graduate class, one of the things I'm going to ask you to do for the graduate classes is, if you don't already have one from when you were in college, pick up a good United States History College intro textbook. And in the syllabus, I will list five or six of the major ones. It's good for context, and it's really good. And what I'm saying is, don't go out and buy one that's, you know, the new ones, the hardcovers, are $130 if you've bought any books in college bookstores recently. So what I'm suggesting is pick up an older edition. You can get those almost free, because once the new edition comes out, then the booksellers can't get any money for the older editions. So you can pick them up for a couple of dollars, $2 or $3, if indeed you don't get them free. And I'm encouraging people to pick up one of those and hold them. But my point is, if you look at the chapters in the textbooks on the Confederation period, the convention, the Constitutional Convention, and ratification, they all tend to be in the same chapter. And ratification is usually a couple of pages tacked on to the end of the chapter on the Constitution. In other words, the big emphasis is on the events leading up to the convention itself, the compromises, and then the story of ratification. And with the exception of a paragraph on the Bill of Rights, there's really not much on ratification. I think what Pauline Meyer's book does is indicate in 650 or so pages that there's a lot more to the ratification story. John's folks have published more than 20 volumes of source materials on ratification for 8 states so far. So, in a sense, what we're finding out is there's a heck of a story there in ratification not covered as teachers, because this is a whole unplowed field for you. Students know nothing about ratification of the Constitution other than it was approved. But the story that goes on in each state as to how the thing gets approved, and the politics within each state to get the Constitution approved, the politics of getting the Bill of Rights through. I mean, these are really incredible stories. And I think all you have to do is think about, when people mention Constitution today, it's the Bill of Rights. And the reality is, the Bill of Rights was not part of the Constitution when the convention closed. So the people who approved the Constitution, the draft of the Constitution in the convention, made a decision that the document that they had just crafted did not need a Bill of Rights. The point I'm trying to make is, now we look at the Bill of Rights as the Constitution in many cases. If you listen to talk radio, that is the Constitution. The Bill of Rights, the Supreme Court interpretations of First Amendment, Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and you know, the Privacy Amendment, all of these things. The issue of whether, in fact, the privacy is in the Constitution or ought to be in the Constitution or is implied in the Constitution, all of these things. Very important. There's a whole story here of information that you could get in that students know nothing about. And there's some fascinating stuff in there, and I think we'll hear about those this morning. So, John, it's yours, baby.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Are there any questions from what we talked about yesterday? You had a full night to consider some things? Yes.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was Stuart Lieberger. Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T. Leiberger is, I believe, L-E-I-B-I-G-E-R. And it's called Founding Friendship. And then subtitles, George Washington and James Madison, et cetera, et cetera. And that the book I mentioned about Greeks bearing gifts, what's the title of that again? Greeks and Romans, was it?
Yeah, Greeks and... Just a second. Now I have to look it up.
Cause... Greeks and Romans bearing gifts? Yes.
I think that was
all. And it's a 2009 book, but would be very, very good for background information. And you said for, what is it, the COS? COS that you have and use it for?
What? There's CSOs in the CSOs. History and the U.S. history, first course U.S. history, that deal with how we got from Greece to here.
Okay. Did you all hear that? CSOs, as a for world history and U.S. history,
mm-hmm.
How we got from Greece to here. That book would be wonderful for that purpose. I didn't mention yesterday about the Constitutional Convention. There's no Bill of Rights, as we all know, came out of that. I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite articles was the Albany Gazette, the 21st of June, 1787. But I didn't tell you at that time what it said the great need was. It talked about we should understand human nature as we humans are, not the theoretical things that John Locke and other philosophers came up with. That is only good in utopia, he says, not in the real world. And he writes this sentence that could never have been written in 1774 or 1776. He says, the problem that we're facing right now is we are wallowing in the superfluity of liberty. We've got too many liberties, and that's our problem. And so what he indicates, and what they all understood, that the Constitutional Convention was not called to take away rights or take away liberty. There were five reasons to have the Constitutional Convention. The first was to maintain the Union. The second was to take powers away from states that had too much power. The third was to give Congress additional powers. The fourth was to give Congress the power to combat the economic depression that they were in and coming out of, unbeknownst to many of them, that they were coming out of that depression. And then the fifth was to restore the image of America abroad. After the Revolution, the image of America was very high. But when that depression hit, and when you get the various debtor legislation passed by the state legislatures, and you get the hue and cry against that, the reputation of Americans began to sink. And they wanted to restore that image. That image is very important, and there's some new books looking at this. It's called the Statist School or the Union School. It's important, these people felt, that we were going to survive in this kind of world with wars, we're going to have to be able to borrow money. And if the only way we borrow money is if we have a sound reputation in the European market where we could borrow money. If we didn't have that sound reputation, it would be very difficult for us to borrow money and thus protect ourselves later on. Yes? Okay, the first reason is maintain the Union. Second reason, to take away powers of the states. Third is to give power to the Congress. Fourth is to give Congress powers that would be able, it would be able to combat the economic depression, authority over currency, banking, commerce, etc. And then the fifth was to restore the image of America abroad. So it wasn't to take away rights from individuals, a Bill of Rights. They were not looking at the fact that we should take away rights from the people. That was not the issue. In fact, what Madison said was if we take up that issue of a Bill of Rights, who knows what's going to happen to the Constitution that we have? I mentioned yesterday that George Mason said, with that book of constitutions, give me 2 or 3 hours and I can write a Bill of Rights. Well, Madison says, that's true, but can we adopt a Bill of Rights without endangering what we've already adopted? And so in the history books, they'll say they were tired and it was a hot summer in Philadelphia. It wasn't a hot summer in Philadelphia. It was a cooler than normal summer. We have the climatic records there. There were certainly some hot days that were very emotionally filled, especially when you're talking about method of representation in early July. Very, very hot and very emotionally charged time in the convention. But as a whole, when they finished, they would like to get home, to be sure, but the fear of undoing what they did was paramount, and that's why they didn't want to take up a Bill of Rights at that point. When Charles Coates with Pinckney goes home, he's asked by the South Carolina Assembly, why is there no Bill of Rights in this Constitution? And he says, well, Bills of Rights are usually premised on the concept that all men are created equal. Look around you. Do you want that in your federal constitution? That all men are created equal? They did it back when they saw the Somerset case in England, how they ruled that, in essence, slavery was illegal in England. And they saw the Quogue Walker case in America in 1781, 1783, where Quogue Walker, a runaway slave, had been accosted by his master, Matthew Jennison, and he wanted to take him back. Walker wouldn't go back into slavery, and so Jennison beat him up, took him back. Walker's friends went to the legal authorities and got an indictment against Jennison for battery. And it came before the Supreme Court, Massachusetts Supreme Court, and they ruled that under the Declaration of Rights of Massachusetts, all men are created equal. Slavery was not legitimate in Massachusetts. And so with the stroke of a pen, William Cushing got rid of slave emancipator. Statewide, that decision. Abraham Lincoln freed no slaves in his Emancipation Proclamation. Where he could have freed slaves, and where he couldn't free slaves, he said they were all free. That is, in territory occupied by the rebel forces. And so Massachusetts becomes the only state without slaves in the Confederation period. And so that's the reason why the convention did not put a Bill of Rights in, because of the entanglement that it would present in all kinds of other issues, and they didn't want to go over that again. They had crafted this document, which they thought was about as perfect as they could get. Didn't please everybody by any means, but they didn't want to rehash the issues again, and they could under the rules of the convention to do it. So that there was another question in the back. Someone had a question back here. Okay. And I put two drawings up here, and I did this at James Madison Elementary School in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I was addressing 3 fourth and fifth grade classes together in one room. I did that twice this day, and I asked, the first question I asked was, what is a constitution? And the little boy in the front row raised his hand and said, it's a promise. Is that nice? And then a little girl raised her hand and she said, it's the laws for the government, not for the people. Again, a very good answer. And then I went to this drawing here and I asked them what they knew about anarchy, and they knew about anarchy. And then I put my angry, despotic mode on and I told them they were all in deep trouble. I said, Mrs. Cosby, I've already assigned her for the dungeon downstairs that I established. She'll be going there very shortly. And so they got trembling a little bit, and I said, that's despotism. And so this is a continuum here of government, going from anarchy to despotism. And what this box indicates is that's on that continuum where you have viable government. Anywhere in that box. It's not a point. It's several points along that continuum. And so when they come together at the Constitutional Convention, they're not aiming with a rifle. They're aiming with a blunderbuss, with a musket, a shotgun, I should say, for a broad area that could be obtained. They don't know exactly what it is, but they know if they give too little power to the central government, eventually what's going to happen is anarchy will result. And when on the with the shining armor on the white stallion will come along and promise stability and benevolence. And we'll get stability. The problem is benevolence will disappear in a short time, and we end up with what? Despotism. And so if you give too little power, you'll eventually end up with despotism. If you go to the right of that box and give too much power to begin with, you'd go directly to despotism. This is Hamilton and Jefferson in this image. Hamilton feared, especially with the image of the French Revolution on right before their radar screen, if you give too little power, you're going to end up with the anarchy that was there, and you'll end up with a reign of terror, and eventually with an emperor. And Jefferson will give us that. The way Hamilton wanted it, you go directly to despotism and monarchy. So there's the two fears that they both have. And the 1790s, which we'll talk about a little bit later today, is predicated upon that, with the French Revolution show as the example of how this might play out. So just as the Americans were the epitome of the Enlightenment, the laboratory of the Enlightenment, so the French Revolution is the vehicle that we can see how human nature is going to react when you have this kind of anarchic situation that develops politically, and when you get just too much democracy, and what will eventually happen. Over here, this is supposed to be a teeter-totter. Do you have those here, totters? Seesaws, as they call it someplace. Normally, what's the fulcrum? It's a triangle, let's say, but the opposite kind of triangle, right? Where you're on a point. But here, this again is government, and it has a much broader fulcrum, where that broad expanse is viable government. So it's not the one point alone. So you have two different kind of images here that you can look at for the kind of government that they want. And every person could have their own perspective. And so Madison, let's say, might want to be over here, but they end up over here. And so he's not satisfied. Hamilton says, if there's anybody that should oppose this government, it's me. And I was talking with Justin yesterday, and he was telling me how Thomas Jefferson was an anti-federalist. And I disagreed with him on that. The textbooks all agree with him, and the textbooks are all wrong. And they're looking at the 1790s. They're not looking at 1787, 1788. What is the definition of a federalist? Somebody who wants the Constitution adopted without any material changes. Not somebody who favors every part of the Constitution. There is no such animal in America. George Washington doesn't favor every part of the Constitution. James Wilson, the arch-federalist, he says, I don't like the Senate at all. So everybody had objections to the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson had two big objections. No Bill of Rights and no limit on the president's number of terms he could serve. He wanted two terms to be the maximum that a person could serve as president. Didn't have either one. There were minor things he said also. But he wanted the Constitution adopted. adamant one of the Constitution adopted, and then we'll get the amendments. Well, that's the standard line of a Federalist. We don't want amendments right now. We'll get amendments later on when experience dictates the kind of amendments that should be adopted. And so I don't see how you could interpret Thomas Jefferson any other way than being a Federalist at this time. Later on, with his opposition to the Federalist Party, the Federalist Party of the 1790s is not the identical party of the Federalists over the Constitution. It changes somewhat. And certainly the Jeffersonians are not the same as the anti-Federalists of 1787-1788. And so there is obviously a movement for an opposition party. It should have been called the Madisonians. I'm not saying that because I'm prejudiced of where I live. But Madison and who else to form the Jeffersonian Party? You folks should know this. No. Because your city, one of your big cities here, is named after him, John Beckley. John Beckley is the political operative from Virginia. He is the secretary or the clerk of everything in Virginia, of the House of Delegates, of the ratifying convention, and becomes the clerk of the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives. And it's he who works with Madison, not Jefferson. Jefferson's at home lounging around or being Secretary of State. He is not forming the party. Madison will communicate with him, but it's Madison and Beckley. Beckley is sort of the whip. That's his job. He's the whip. And he and Madison are the ones who form the opposition party. So you should be very proud of John Beckley and know who he is. I was surprised. I asked Bill maybe last year or the year before that, who was Beckley named after, thinking it maybe was somebody in the 1860s or that. But no, he said it was John Beckley from back in the 1780s and 1790s. And so that party is different. And in fact, they would say they didn't form the first party. They would say Alexander Hamilton formed the first party. And they formed their party in reaction to what Hamilton formed. And so they are reaction. I don't agree with either one of them. I believe the first political parties in America got established in the early 1780s. And the division was the French. And so you have the Jeffersonian group that want to advance, that want to ally the country with Great Britain. And that has strong, cohesive force at the time, but it sets the foundation for the party system that develops later on. And it is that question of, do we lean toward the French or do we lean toward the British? And Hamilton obviously decides to go for the British because, partly of money, that his system is going to be run by the duties, the import duties that are generated from the trade with Great Britain primarily. Any questions on that? What I'd like to do this morning is looking at ratification. There are two ways to look at ratification. The process that took place and how it actually happened. And the other is to look at the issues involved. And I want to do both. And so first I want to look at the overall picture and how it happened. There are really 14 debates that take place over the ratification of the Constitution. There's a debate in every state. It is state-oriented. And there's a national debate that is going on. You could even argue that there are some regional debates going on as well. But I picture that as part of the national debate. And so you have these two different levels. And every state has its own party alignment in the 1780s. Jackson Turner Maine published a book on state politics before the Constitution. Political scientists like to say that there were no during the Revolutionary Era. That's because the political parties, in their judgment, do not have all the attributes that a political party is supposed to have today. Well, I think it's very 20th century, 21st century oriented. And these people back then believed that there were political parties. If you look at the Clintonians in New York and the Hamiltonians or Schuylerites in New York, it's party structure. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I indicate that in my biography of George Clinton. You can see the party structure that's there, the leadership in New York City, and how they've got party lieutenants all over the place. And so each of these states has its own party structure, and it aligns on the Constitution a little differently in each state. And but generally speaking, you have the Democratic forces, the more Democratic Party, is opposed to the Constitution, and the more Aristocratic Party favors the Constitution. You do have people who cross over, and that's particularly true in Virginia, where you have the elites in Virginia really dividing evenly. And so, that is epitomized by the Lee family alone. If you look at two of the leaders of the Lee family, Richard Henry Lee and Arthur Lee, they're both ardent anti-federalists. But if you look at their brother, Francis Lightfoot Lee, he's not. And you look at their cousins, Henry Lee and Charles Lee, they're federalists as well. And so that the Lee family is really divided in much the same way that the total elites are in Virginia. It is an unusual place. Most of the time, the good people are the arts, that is, doctors, lawyers, merchants, who else am I excluding, the large landowners. These folks are generally federalists, and the smaller farmers are generally anti-federalists. But Virginia, that's not the case. Local judges are usually anti-federal. Again, not always the case, but they're afraid what the federal judiciary might do to the state judiciary. And so we can look at several different stages of ratification, and that's what I want to talk about today. The very first stage of ratification occurs before the Constitutional Convention meets. This is after it's called or during the time when it's called. The Annapolis Convention meets yesterday. It was supposed to discuss commercial matters. It really wasn't. It was a subterfuge to get to a larger convention to deal with political issues. And that's exactly what they did. There's a wonderful letter by the French consul, Otto. He's a German, but he's in the French service. He knows what's going on. The French are the most astute as far as the diplomats in America. And I have a wonderful letter here. If you're interested, I don't have time to read it. It's a long letter. I published it in one of the books I co-edited with Richard Leffler called Federalists and Anti-Federalists. I don't know if you've ever seen that book. It's a wonderful book for classroom use because it has seven different subjects. The nature, Senate, the judiciary, the presidency, the Bill of Rights, and then we added in the second edition the economic consequences of the Constitution, the economic divisions over the Constitution. And what we do is we have a page and a half introduction that explains it totally, each issue. And then we've got documents, the anti-federal side and the federal side. And there they are. So even if the students don't want to read the documents or can't understand the documents, so we've been told by teachers, they can read that one-page introduction and understand what the issues are and participate in the debate. And so that document by Otto that I'll have here if any of you want to look at it, and if enough of you want to look at it, I'll actually read it, but it'll probably take about a minute to read it, so long. But it's a fabulous document, and I just told you what he's saying. This is fraud that they're perpetrating. The people are the wealthy people, most of them, they want this stronger central government, and they're doing it in a surreptitious way. And the people don't know what's happening. They're in the dark on this. The convention is called by the Annapolis Convention, calling a constitutional convention, and Congress does the same thing on February 21st, 1787. And so we've got this period of time before May when they're supposed to come together. And there's a concentrated movement throughout the country to prepare for this. Madison especially is doing this himself, but others as well. And newspapers all over the country are, for the first time in total unity, arguing for the acceptance of no matter what the convention comes up with. So whereas before, whenever Congress made a recommendation for, there were us that looked askance at this as Congress trying to feather its own nest, Congress trying to get power. This is a dangerous thing. But now it's not Congress that is proposing amendments. It's going to be this convention, and there's this united feeling, with especially when they find out that Washington and Franklin are going to be there, we've got to accept whatever is being done. And so you get this, and several newspaper printers actually come out and state this in their editorial policies. There are about 90 newspapers in the country, about 35 in New England, about 35 in the middle states, and then about 20, 25 in the south. And they circulate all over the country. There's a circulation pattern that's there. And news is exchanged in this fashion. Virtually all of the newspapers argue, accept whatever comes out of the convention. What happens is once it comes out of the convention, you probably have about a half a dozen anti-Federalist newspapers. They won't publish any Federalist stuff to speak of. And you get about a half a dozen Federalist newspapers that won't publish any anti-Federalist material. The rest of the newspapers are all Federalist leaning. And they publish a lot of Federalist stuff, but some anti-Federalist stuff. And so the Federalists have real advantage when it comes to the newspapers. It's sort of this continued onslaught, not just the big articles, but also the smaller articles and the news filtering from one state to another of what is happening in this ratification process. So that's the first stage of ratification, even before the together and during the convention. This idea of selling the Constitutional Convention. John Alexander from the University of Cincinnati has written a book called that, The Selling of the Constitution. And he did that by looking at our sources that we have, our newspaper sources that we collected during the sitting of the Constitutional Convention. And so the secrecy rule was there, but every once in a while you get the Pennsylvania Herald, there's a leak that's there telling what the convention is doing. First time that this happens, they come out and they say, we can't tell you what we're doing, but we can tell you what we're not doing. We are not considering a monarchy, so don't worry about that. But there are various leaks that come out over the course of that four-month period of time. The second stage of ratification, I mentioned a little bit yesterday, was the convention itself, how they handled it. And I think I told you what they selected upon. They selected ratifying conventions rather than the state legislatures, which the Articles of Confederation call for. And that made it a lot easier, only 13 state conventions to go to rather than 24 legislative bodies. And Congress need not ratify. Congress need not approve. That's what it says in the Articles of Confederation. Congress would approve amendments. No, it was felt it was inappropriate for Congress to commit suicide, because that's what it was going to be. If Congress approved the Constitution, it would be the death knell for the Confederation Congress. And so it was felt inappropriate. And so that was not necessary. And then how many states should ratify? And I discussed that briefly yesterday. saying that it was really heavily disputed. It couldn't be 13. Could it be 12? Well, maybe 12. It'd be 7, but would that give you a majority of people? Probably not. And so they chose the number 9 I mentioned to you yesterday. That was a number they were familiar with from the Articles of Confederation. It took 9 states to do important things. And so it would take 9 states to ratify. And it would go into effect among the 9 states once they ratified. Well, what's going to happen to the other 4? Nothing in the Constitution mentions the other 4. And in the limited times when this was discussed in the ratification debate, the idea was, they're okay, they're on their own, no problem. There is a problem when Rhode Island is alone. Rhode Island all by itself in 1790, and eventually the Senate passes a bill to boycott Rhode Island totally, and no one can trade with it. Also, they had to become a portion of the federal debt immediately. So there was a club that was there. That's the last stage of ratification I just gave you. But they don't say that in the beginning. They say those states that stay out of the Union, it's fine. We're not going to coerce them in any way. That's not true. They do coerce Rhode Island to come into the Union. In actuality, the anti-federal states are saying there's a secession that's taking place. They're leaving the Union. They're leaving the perpetual Union established by the Articles of Confederation. We're not leaving. They are. And they're violating the Articles of Confederation in the process. They also violated their instructions from the state legislatures, and they violated the congressional resolution of 21 February calling the Constitutional Convention. So that's the second, the Constitutional Convention itself. The third stage is the Confederation Congress. When the Constitutional Convention adjourns, they have a 6-page broadside of the Constitution that's been printed by Dunlap and Claypool, the printers of the Pennsylvania Packet. The delegates to the convention are given copies of this, and the engrossed copy of the Constitution, that 4 pages, written by whom? Who did I tell you yesterday? Who did I tell you? Not Timothy Matlock, who wrote the Declaration, as you said. No, Gouverneur Morris wrote the words. But who actually wrote the engrossed copy? Who did I say? You didn't write it down? Jacob Shallus. Jacob Shallus is the... That version, 4 pages it took up, delivered by the convention secretary to the Secretary of Congress. And so you have the same Constitution, 2 different forms, a printed form and a engrossed form on parchment. The delegates each get several copies. Some of the states required that the delegates report back to the legislature after the convention was over. And they wanted to take this Constitution back with them. And so on the 20th of September, the convention adjourns on the 17th. On the 20th of September, the Constitution is read in Congress. They assign the 26th, the day that they will debate the Constitution. And when that happens, you have 2 sides. You get members of Congress there. 5 or 6 are anti-federalists. I'm using the term now, anti-federalists and federalists. I didn't want to use that term when I talked about the Constitutional Convention, because they're not federalists and they're not anti-federalists at that time. They don't become federalists and anti-federalists until you've got a constitution, because you can never tell what's going to happen to that draft constitution in the convention, what is going to end up being, and therefore you don't know what these people will be. Some of them obviously have anti-federal feelings. That term, federal men, originated in 1786. And that was supposed to apply to men who wanted additional powers for Congress. And obviously, those people who didn't want additional powers for Congress would be called anti-federal men. And so those terms carried over, and it was the Federalists who wanted those, and the anti-Federalists don't like it at all. The anti-Federalists said, we are the real Federalists. The real Federalist believes in a confederation government. You are nationalists. You are consolidators. That's what you are. You're not Federalists. You are the anti-Federalists. But it doesn't hold. The Federalists get that benefit. I'm waiting for someone to write such an article. I've got a stack of notes that high on the terms federal and anti-federal people. And so it's a real heated issue at the time. So you've got now, Congress is debating this issue, and the overwhelming number of them are Federalists. About 10 of them were in the Constitutional Convention. Now they come from Philadelphia to New York City, and they're going to debate this. And right away, as is surprising, the history books don't tell you this, and different, it's surprising that the anti-Federalists take the lead in the debate. They do this in Congress, and they do this in the media. And what they do, Nathan Dane, which our county is named after, is the author of the Northwest Ordinance. Nathan Dane from Massachusetts is an anti-Federalist, a moderate anti-Federalist at this time. He says, okay, we should, the argument here in Congress is how do we send it out to the states? They agree that they shouldn't have to approve it. They won't approve it. They won't attack it. But the anti-Federalists say, let's send it to the states with a resolution that they should consider ratifying conventions. But let's premise this with a preamble saying, yes, they met in the Constitutional Convention. Yes, they violated the resolutions of Congress. Yes, they violated their... And yes, the Confederation. So that's going to be the premise. Federalists don't like this. This is not a way to be neutral on the Constitution. What Federalists want is to send it to the states with the approbation of Congress. They don't have to approve, but let's do it. Let's say it's a wonderful document, and we'll give the endorsement. Well, the opposition doesn't like that at all. And then what happens is you get the cry for amendments. Richard Henry Lee takes the lead in that regard. And not only does he say we should have amendments, he proposes a list of amendments in the form of a Bill of Rights and other amendments. And they debate this, and Madison says, you can't do this. You can't amend this Constitution. This Constitution is the product of a committee that we created as Congress, and that committee is gone. We can't send it back to the committee. It's disbanded. Therefore, we have a report that we've got to live with. The opposition gets up and says, what are you talking about, Mr. Madison? We, as a parent, as the Congress, we appoint a committee. The committee comes back with a report, and we can't change the committee report? Never heard of such a thing. The parent can always change the proposal of a committee. Madison says, well, you're right. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. But if we do that, we've got two constitutions. The one sent by the convention and then this new one amended by Congress. We might get five states ratifying one and five states ratifying the other. What kind of pickle are we in then? A constitutional crisis. Let's ratify one. The one sent out by the convention, the one that printed constitution, the state legislatures, they got it directly from the convention. Let's ratify that, and then we'll get the amendments later on. That makes sense to a lot of people. At least to the Federalists, it makes sense. The anti-Federalists realize they can't stop this. They only have five or six people in this legislature, in Congress. And so they get a compromise. What they're going to do is to send the Constitution to the states without approbation, just send it out neutrally, and then they will wipe the slate clean of any opposition. Even the Richard Henry Lee amendments, the Bill of Rights, you see in the Manuscript Journal a big fax through it. And the printed journal that circulates throughout the country has no reference to that at all. And then these great politicians, as Federalists are, they word the resolution appropriately, put the word unanimous in. Congress unanimously sends this Constitution to the states. What does that imply? Approbation, right? Madison lays this all out in a letter to George Washington. Washington responds and says, wonderful. It would have been nice to get the approbation, but the unanimity, seemingly unanimity in favor of the Constitution, is wonderful. Not everybody has the opportunity to peep behind the curtain and see what really happened. And so this is an effort that Federalists have at a bandwagon approach. Governor Morris in the Constitutional Convention said, we've got to ratify this thing quickly because the longer we wait, the more opposition will be there. So quick, 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 we've got to do this. And this is part of the strategy of Federalists in Congress. So that's the third stage of ratification. Any questions? At that same time, that week, Pennsylvania is very active. For about 10 days, the last 10 days of the convention, the Pennsylvania Assembly is sharing the State House with the Constitutional Convention. The Constitutional Convention is meeting downstairs, and the Assembly is meeting upstairs. Downstairs is the Assembly regular meeting chamber, but they don't kick the Constitutional Convention out. And so the day after they ratify, after they adopt the Constitution, in the Constitutional Convention, the Pennsylvania delegation presents the Constitution to the Assembly. Benjamin Franklin does this and urges them not only to call a convention to ratify, but to provide land for the permanent federal capital of the United States. A block of land, 100 square miles. Not 10 square miles, 100 square miles. It's 10 miles square. That's 100 square miles. It's a big piece of property. The Assembly is dominated by Federalists. They're going to adjourn by the end of September to call state elections for the Assembly. Every year they do this. And one of the problems that James Madison saw in the vices of the political system was what he called the multiplicity and mutability of state laws. You know what multiplicity means. Many, many laws. What about mutability? What does he mean by that? Yes. Change. Exactly. And how do they change? When you get a different party elected annually, they'll repeal the laws on the books, and when they get voted out the next year, those laws are repealed, and new laws are put there. They get voted out, again a change. There's mutability, there's change. You can't rely upon anything. In 1784, the radicals, the constitutionalists, that is, those who favor the state constitution, they got elected in Pennsylvania, and they repealed the charter of the Bank of North America. The next year, the Republicans, the conservatives, are elected, and they want to repeal the repeal of the charter. And they have a wonderful debate. Gordon Wood, in his book, The Radicalism of the American Revolution, he has this phrase that he uses over and over again. It's hard to overestimate the importance of this issue. And there is a speech that's given in the Pennsylvania Assembly. I think it was by Whitehill. John Whitehill, that is. And Gordon Wood says, it is hard to overestimate the importance of this speech. It is the most important speech in American history. It's going to determine who will have access to capital. Will farmers have access to capital, or will merchants only have access to capital? If the bank survives, it will give short-term credit to merchants, 45 days credit, and the farmers will have no access to capital. The whole direction of the country is determined by this speech and how it goes over. It's hard to overestimate the importance of this speech. Now, Edmund Morgan, the great old 90-year-old historian from Yale, he reviewed that book. And he said, Professor Wood has said it's hard to overestimate that speech. He's done it. He has overestimated the importance of that speech. It is not that important, he says. But you see what is going on in Pennsylvania. The division that's there. And they are changing these laws back and forth. And so the Federalists, who are in control, they're in control of the Assembly, are afraid of the next election. Will they be able to control the next election? They're not sure they will be able to. And therefore, they want to get a convention called right away. Furthermore, if they don't get a convention called right away, they'll have to wait till the next Assembly comes together. They won't get a convention until the following summer. They want to get a convention soon. The sooner the better, because they feel confident that they can get it ratified, the Constitution ratified. And so they want to call a convention. The anti-Federalists, they say, whoa, you're acting like now. You're acting like a state here instead of part of this great union that we have. We have to wait till Congress considers this and sends it to us. We've got to wait for that. Well, they're not even taking it up yet. And they don't take it up to the 26th. Finally, what happens is on the 29th of September, the day after Congress acts, in the morning, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, an unofficial word comes, Congress has sent the Constitution to the states. And so in the morning on the 29th, they call a convention. And they then adjourn for lunch. When they come back, what happens? Exactly what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, earlier this year. Then it was the anti-Federalists. And with Madison, it was the Democrats. They stayed away. They didn't come. And there was no quorums to make a quorum in Pennsylvania. And there's a quorum of 2/3 necessary for money bills in the Wisconsin legislature, Wisconsin Senate and Assembly. This was a money bill they were thinking of in Wisconsin. And so the Democrats had one more than necessary to stop a 2/3 majority. And the anti-Federalists had two more than was necessary to stop a quorum. And so the anti-Federalists stayed away. They were ordered to come back. They didn't come back. The assistant clerk and the sergeant-at-arms were sent out. They came back and said, we saw them. They were scurrying around, but we couldn't get anybody. They were sent out again in the afternoon, this time with a mob to support them. They brought back two anti-Federalists, sat them down, locked the doors. The anti-Federalists are willing to pay money for their penalty. They want to take the money. They said, can't leave to go to the bathroom. Nope, sorry, got to stay there. And they took the roll call, and they said they were there. They shouldn't have said that they were there, but they did. And then they finished the call of a convention. Where it would sit? In Philadelphia, not in Carlisle, not in Pittsburgh. And the date of the election, would be the 6th of November. Very quick, which is what the Federalists wanted. And other things were decided, and the convention was called. When the convention came together, the 2/3 were Federalists. And they debated the Constitution. Came together in October, November, that is, November 20th. And they debated the Constitution for 3 weeks. The big issue is a Bill of Rights. Should there be a Bill of Rights? And the Federalist position is no Bill of Rights. No amendments whatsoever. You've got to... It is no partway measure here. And... They want a Bill of Rights. They propose a Bill of Rights. They're Benjamin Rush says, give us a Bill of Rights. And they do. Poor James Wilson. He's got two bunglers on his hands in this convention. The Chief Justice, who was a former opponent, a former constitutionalist favoring the state constitution, and Benjamin Rush. They're playing in the hands of the anti-Federalists. Wilson wants to cut off the anti-federalist. And McKean, Chief Justice Thomas McKean, and Benjamin Rush are egging them on. Come on, bring in your amendments. No, they don't want to have the amendments. Benjamin Rush says on the 12th of December, which is the day they're going to vote on the Constitution, let's all vote. Let's be brothers again. I want to come up and hug my friends with you. William Chambers gets up and says, I don't want to be friends with you. I don't like you. I don't want to hug you. I just want to vote in favor of the Constitution. That's their attitude. That's the Tea Party folks back then. No compromise here. And so they vote and they approve the Constitution without the amendments, and they vote to keep the amendments off the journal, something they never had done before. And so the anti-federalists publish their stance. First of all, in the Assembly, they published the reasons for seceding from the Assembly. They did that in October, and then in December, they published the reasons for opposing the Constitution in the Convention. And the Federalists are happy throughout the country that Pennsylvania has ratified. They're not happy with the mob that was used. It's very embarrassing. Is this the way we're going to run our government? By mobs? So it's an embarrassing thing nationwide. During the course of that debate, that three-week debate in Pennsylvania, that sneaky little state, Delaware, comes along, and they vote to have a convention. They're all Federalists. They meet for 3 days. They discuss the Constitution for 3 hours, and they ratify before Pennsylvania, and they're listed as the first state. That's what they say, the first state. My grandson asked me at dinner on Saturday, who was the first state? And I said, do you mean colonies? He said, yes. And I said, Virginia. Virginia was the first colony? How come Delaware says it was the first? And then I explained to him, that was the Constitution, not the colonies. But Virginia was the first colony, Delaware the first state to ratify the Constitution. Not only does Delaware ratify the Constitution, but New Jersey follows on the 18th of December, and Georgia follows on either the 29th of January or the 29th of December or the 2nd of January. Why do I say two dates? It's the same issue as independence in Congress. They vote on the 2nd of July for independence, but the declaration is the 4th. In Georgia, they vote on the 29th of December to ratify, but their document, their form of ratification, is dated the 2nd of January. So you've got those two dates that are competing. And because they straddle the year, you know, the question is how many states ratify in 87? Well, maybe Georgia did in 87, maybe they did in 88, who knows. And then Connecticut ratifies also, and on the 10th of January. They don't debate very long, and they ratify by two-thirds majority. Three of those states, Jersey and Georgia, ratify unanimously. These are all somewhat small states in a way, and they want this central government. They each have their peculiar needs. Washington says it would be surprising if Georgia voted against the Constitution with the Creek Indians on one side and the Spanish on the other side. They need our protection. And New Jersey is described by James Madison as a keg tapped on both ends. What he meant by that is you've got on one side of New Jersey, New York City, on the other side, Philadelphia. These are the two great ports, and all the foreign goods are coming in through those two ports. And both states have a very substantial tariff that's coming in. And because of that tariff, they don't have to issue land taxes. They've got all this tariff money coming in. And who's paying the tariff? A lot of New Yorkers are paying the tariff. But a lot of those goods coming in are being reshipped to Connecticut and Massachusetts and Vermont. And these states, and Delaware, these states are paying inflated costs for those goods to help pay for the cost of the tariff that the merchant is paying. So, in essence, New Jersey folks are paying indirectly into the New York coffers to the tune of over 30,000 pounds a year. Connecticut's paying 50,000 pounds a year into the New York coffers. You see why New York doesn't like the Constitution. That money is going to go to the federal government. It will not go to New Jersey, New York. So New York is able to keep a low tax base of land taxes and items from Washington County, upstate New York. He says this is a God-given gift, the port of New York City. God gave it to us. We ought to utilize it and not give it up. So that's why New Jersey wants to come in. They don't want their impost money going to New York. They want it going to the central government that will help them. And so each state has its own peculiar reason for favoring or opposing the Constitution. But this is the fourth stage of ratification, where no amendments are allowed, and it's an easy ratification. Unanimous in three of the states, and two-thirds in the other two states, Connecticut and Pennsylvania. Any questions on that? The next stage is Massachusetts, all alone. What's that? Massachusetts is the largest state in New England. How Massachusetts goes, probably New Hampshire will go. Do the math. What does that tell you? Rhode Island will not ratify. New York will not ratify. If Massachusetts doesn't ratify, New Hampshire won't ratify. That's four states. That leaves only nine. One other state, that's the end of the Constitution. Massachusetts is critical. They've got to get Massachusetts. And Massachusetts is big, population-wise. It's probably the second largest state in the sense that it's 400,000 people. Virginia has 800,000 people, a lot of slaves. Massachusetts has 400,000 people, no slaves. Pennsylvania has 400,000 people, but quite a few slaves. And in the apportioned federal taxes, at three-fifths. In the new Constitution, representation will be apportioned, three-fifths of slaves being counted. Since there are no slaves in Massachusetts, they have a higher number of people, even though they've got 400,000 in each state. No slaves, no three-fifths of that population, only five-fifths of those people, white or black, are being counted for apportionment purposes. So Massachusetts comes together. There are almost 400 towns. Nobody knows how they're going to vote. The difference between the House of Representatives of Massachusetts and the convention is that the towns must pay for their representatives to go to their state House of Representatives. And a lot of the towns don't have the money to do it. Particularly the further west you are, or if you're on Dukes County, which is Nantucket, it's hard for them to afford sending representatives in. But for the convention, the state is paying for it. And so everybody can send delegates to the ratifying convention, and they do. And so you've got almost 400 delegates there, and a lot of these people are new to the game. They don't know how they're going to vote. And so no one is sure. This is an untested conglomeration of people. What we do know is that John Hancock, Governor John Hancock, vain as can be, desiring popularity, he wants to be president of the convention. And he is elected president of the convention. But he doesn't want to take a stand until he knows which way the political wind is blowing. And so what does he do? It's quite appropriate, it seems, that he has an attack of the gout. He usually has an attack of the gout whenever it's politically expedient. Anyone here have the gout? Anybody here have the gout? I have the gout. The pain is excruciating. It's hard to describe the pain. It's the worst pain I've ever had in my life. Someone told me that kidney stones are worse. I've never had kidney stones, so I can't tell. But I have in my study a recliner. and I often read in my recliner. I have a ceiling fan. If I have an attack of the gout, I can't have that ceiling fan on. The pain that it gives me is too excruciating. In a toe or an ankle or an elbow, wherever joint is affected, the pain is just too tremendous from this fan. I can't have a sheet on. The sheet is too heavy. Now, fortunately, there's medication for this. There's even more of this advertised on TV now, I see. But I don't take those kind of medication. I think I'd rather, maybe if I had an attack of the gout, I'd rather die than have that attack of the gout. But the medication I have is so wonderful. You take 3 tablets, this is for chronic, and it will forestall an attack. If by some reason I was taking 1 pill a day, and I get an attack every 6 months or so, but I take another pill, and it would vanish. I can't imagine what Benjamin Franklin or Johnny Hancock or George III wouldn't have given for this kind of medication. That's why I say I'm happy I'm living now. I would have been one of those afflicted with the gout back then. And it is painful. And so they wrap it up to protect it from this kind of breeze, from touching anything. The pain is so terrible. Just a breeze. You're in agony. I cannot get across to you the pain involved. And so he draws upon this. And more frequently than he normally does. And this is the occasion when he has an attack of the gout. So he stays home. After 3 weeks of debating, and they go regularly to visit him, both sides, it's determined that the anti-federalists have won. When the vote is taken, the Constitution will be defeated. So what are they to do? The Federalists understand the dire predicament that they're in. And they come up with this ingenious plan. These are great, great politicians. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, we talk about the philosophy coming up with the Constitution. It wouldn't have happened if they weren't great politicians. They needed to have that kind of expertise. So what they do is they draft 9 amendments. They were the ones saying before, Federalists all over the country, no amendments. Now they changed their story. Yes, we can have amendments, but the mandatory amendments will recommend to the first federal Congress that they consider these amendments under Article 5 of the Constitution and let it go from there. And they propose their amendments. And then what do? They say the best person to present this is who? John Hancock. So they go to his house and they say, John, you know we hate your guts and we hate your politics, rightly so, but we got a deal for you. We've got these 9 amendments here, recommendatory, and if you agree to present these as yours, we won't run a candidate against you for governor in the spring of 1787. You're guaranteed re-election. And we're going to support you for Vice President of the United States. And you know, John, the Constitution. And if Virginia doesn't ratify the Constitution, George Washington will not be eligible to be the first president. What do you think, John? The next day, he's carried into the convention on a litter. And he says, do I have a plan for you? Here it is. I've written this up the other night. I was thinking about this. Here is my plan. Some anti-federalists say, well, that's not your handwriting, John. I know your handwriting. That's the handwriting of Theophilus Parsons, who's an arch-federalist. This is mine. This is mine. And with that, Samuel Adams seconds the resolution for these amendments. These recommendatory amendments, and they achieve ratification by a majority of 19. 19 out of almost 400. This is the turning point of ratification. 6 of the remaining 7 states use this method of ratifying. Thomas Jefferson buys into this. He writes back and he says, you know, what I favored is 9 states should ratify, 4 should stay out, and sort of keep themselves hostage so that we get some amendments, like a Bill of Rights. And once we get those amendments, then the other 4 can come in. He says, I don't like that anymore. I like Massachusetts' way. recommendatory amendments. That's the way to do it. Let's come into the union and work that way. And so this is a critical event in the ratification process. Those amendments are proposed. Now what happens is later on, starting with Virginia, we get many more amendments. We get 40 amendments in Virginia. They put 20 in a Bill of Rights, and they put 20 in structural amendments to the Constitution. But that's a little bit later down the road, the fifth stage. The sixth stage is not so happy for Federalists. The first thing that happens is New Hampshire meets. And now with this ratification in Massachusetts on the 6th of February, it's thought, well, they're going to ratify New Hampshire. But they don't. What do? They adjourn. They adjourn to June. Why do they adjourn? As soon as they get in the convention, John Lansing and John Langdon, the two Federalist leaders, they realize, Samuel Livermore is involved in this also, they realize the Anti-Federalists have a majority if you couple together those who oppose the Constitution with those who have been instructed by their towns to oppose the Constitution. That's got a majority. And so right away, before they discuss anything, these guys are so smart politically, they put forth a motion to adjourn. And a motion to adjourn trumps everything. It's the first thing they've got to consider. And they adjourn to the 18th of June, 4 months later. And so they forestall a defeat of the Constitution. But it's not success. It is shocking that New Hampshire adjourns. The next is Rhode Island. They don't call for a convention. They call a referendum. The freemen are to vote in their towns, and then those votes will be tabulated in the legislature at a statewide tabulation. There are 30 towns. And we'll see what they do. And it's reported they defeat the Constitution over 11-1 against the Constitution. In reality, it was about 3 or 4-1. But the big Federalist towns like Providence, they boycott the referendum. They won't vote. Only 2 towns vote in favor of the Constitution. The other 28 vote against it. Even in Providence and Newport, they vote against it. Providence, the vote is 1-0 against the Constitution. Because when the Federalists didn't vote, the Anti-Federalists didn't vote, except for one, so that they got the town. And so that's the second bad mark against the Constitution. New Hampshire adjourns, Rhode Island votes against the Constitution. And then it's reported that North Carolina has ratified. Whoops, they didn't ratify. We thought they ratified, and so this premature announcement, and then the Federalists are red in the face when it turns out, no, they didn't ratify. You're giving false information. And so these are 3 black marks here. That's the 6th stage of ratification. And then comes where you in South Carolina meeting. And Maryland, this is one of the very few times when George Washington is discovered working behind the scenes. Washington keeps out of active politicking. He won't even run for the Virginia Convention, much to the chagrin of Federalists in Virginia. They figure he's worth at least 10 votes in that convention, and he won't deign to serve. That could be the death of the Constitution in Virginia, but he won't serve. And yet he writes to his friend Thomas Johnson in Maryland, and he says, you guys better ratify in Maryland before Virginia comes, because if you don't ratify, if we don't have 9 states ratifying before Virginia, they won't ratify. The Anti-Federalists will be elated, and they'll defeat the Constitution. So you've got to get moving in Maryland. That becomes public now. Schroeding shouldn't do that. He is embarrassed that comes out. And so they meet together in Maryland, and they hire a shorthand note taker, the same man who took the notes in the Pennsylvania Convention. They publish those notes in the Pennsylvania Convention. What are they? In Volume 1. Volume 2 never shows up. Volume 1, James Wilson's speeches, and Thomas McKean's speeches. Two Federalists. No anti-Federalist speeches are published in the pamphlet journal of the speeches of Pennsylvania. In Maryland, they hire the same man to do the note-taking, and they're so heavy-handed that they won't allow these notes to be published. It's an embarrassment. They don't want what has just happened to be carried on in that Maryland will reject the Constitution. They don't give any quarter. They ramrod this through. They're quite dictatorial, tyrannical in how they run the convention in Maryland, but they get ratification. They say, trust us to the anti-Federalists. We'll give you amendments, just ratify, and then we'll have discussions over amendments. They did that, and then they said, we're not favoring amendments. And they got rid of the amendments. So Maryland is the only state, remember I said, 6 of the 7 remaining states follow Massachusetts' example. Maryland is the one state that doesn't. All the other states that come follow Massachusetts' example. And then South Carolina ratifies. South Carolina is the only state in which the legislature that considers calling a convention actually discusses the substantive value of the Constitution. All the other state legislatures, do we have a convention or shouldn't we have a convention? That's the issue. Not the Constitution per se. But in South Carolina, in the House of Representatives, for a 3-day period, they discuss the good and bad aspects of the Constitution. And so when the convention comes together, it's already been discussed. These people already discussed it. And they're the same people that were elected to the legislature. They're now elected to the convention. And they ratify very quickly. And so that ends the seventh stage of ratification. And you've got now 8 states that have ratified. Virginia's coming up. June is the big month. This is the super primary day to have an equivalent today. Virginia will meet the 2nd of June. New York meets the 17th of June. And New Hampshire meets second session the 18th of June. Will we have a constitution or not? By this time, it's presumed New Hampshire will ratify. The word has gotten around. Many of the towns have taken off their instructions. And because of the momentum of the other states' ratification, it's thought that New Hampshire will ratify. And they, in fact, do. But Virginia comes together. No one knows what's going to happen in Virginia. There are some wild cards there. The Kentucky delegates, how will they vote? And they're suspicious of this new central government, particularly because of the Mississippi River. Remember what I talked about yesterday with John Jay and Gardoki and those negotiations. They're very fearful. 2 days of the convention are devoted to the Mississippi question. And Madison says we're safer under the Constitution than under the greater likelihood that the Mississippi will be given up under the Articles of Confederation, because it's a single house legislature. Under the new Constitution, in the Senate, how many states are necessary to ratify treaties? How many? 2/3. Why is it 2/3? Because the southern states demanded in the Constitutional Convention a veto power over all treaties, because they realized Jay Gardoki. They are not going to let the majority in the North